You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a science journalist joins us for a look at NASA plans to put humans back on the moon with a series of Artemis missions and why the first launch has been delayed twice so far. Now, building a house is a big job that requires a lot of labor, framing, drywalling. The list goes on and on for different tasks involved. In Green Bay, a new set of workers are learning the ropes of home building, high school students. That's as part of the school district's Bridges Construction and Renovation Program. Let students work on building real homes from start to finish in vacant lots around the city or renovating existing homes. Brian Furk is the instructor for the Bridges construction class with the Green Bay Area Public School District, and Kira Brozig is a senior at Green Bay East High School and a student in the class. I talked to both of them from their current job site earlier today. Let's start with you, Brian. Can you tell us where the idea for a project like this came from?
There was a need in the Green Bay area for and statewide and nationwide for more young people to get into the construction trades. So a while back, there was a partnership between the local construction industry as well as some nonprofits like Habitat for Humanity and NeighborWorks of Green Bay, who are interested in affordable homes, as well as the city of Green Bay, who wanted to put some houses on some of their vacant lots. And they put together a program where students could learn about the industry and hopefully provide more future employees for the construction industry.
Kira, what got you interested in signing up for the class?
Well, my grandfather worked in construction for most of his life, and my uncle got into it, and I just wanted to see how it was like and, like, if it was an industry that I wanted to get into and, like, work in when I get to that point to picking to where I want to work.
Brian, can you tell us, how does this class work? What do the students actually do?
They do a little bit of everything. We learn how to locate the house on the job site. We'll go out and drive stakes and shoot elevations. Then we have local contractors come in and actually do the concrete work for us, the foundation of the house and the garage. And then we go ahead and start framing. The students show up 5 days a week. It's a 3-hour-long class every day for the whole year. The students come directly to the job site, and then we start framing a house. And we carry through all the way to the end. They do a little bit of everything. They do framing. They do drywall, siding, roofing, pretty much finished carpentry, install doors and windows, pretty much a little bit of everything within it by the end of the year.
Kira, it's a new project. What have you done so far? And what is the project you're working on?
Well, so far with the housing, we've staked out what the house would look like, and then we practiced shooting levels to the stakes where the house would be. And then over this past week, we've been working at a remodel house that was being redone throughout last year as well. But during the past week, we, as a class, put on a back patio and put in flooring and the railing and everything that it needed.
And Brian, what does the home selling part of this class end up with? Who do these houses end up getting sold to?
We work with NeighborWorks of Green Bay. They're actually, they provide all the funding through donations to NeighborWorks. They fund the house. They're the general contractor. My students provide the labor. And then at the end, the house is sold. The profits then go back into NeighborWorks so they can do other things that they do, like low-cost loans for down payments for people who are struggling to come up with the down payment for a home.
And Kira, no matter what field you end up going into, do you feel like you're learning skills that are going to be useful throughout your life?
Oh, yeah, definitely. All of the stuff I'm learning in this class so far, I'm definitely going to be able to use, definitely when I get older, if I'm not going to be using it, like, for work, I'm going to be able to admire more of what goes into building and in the long run be able to just, I don't know, use it as an experience. Mm.
And Brian, I understand part of the goal is not just to teach your students construction skills, but also just the basics of job skills. Can you talk about what you hope they take away from this?
Absolutely. I came to teaching about 5 years ago at 50 years old, and I came out of the construction industry. And having been out there, I know what employers are looking for. So I stress to my students over and over that the most important thing is that they show up every day on time, that, you know, they show some respect for their employers and that they put in a full day's work for a full day's pay. The real hard thing these days isn't the technical skills. Sometimes it's the soft skills, being there every day and putting in a hard day's work.
Kira, someday you'll be done with these projects and you'll be hanging out, walking around or driving around in Green Bay, and you'll go buy a house that you either helped build or helped renovate. I don't know. How do you think that's going to feel?
It's going to be awesome. I'm going to feel very accomplished being like pointing it out to people and say like, I did that and I had a great time doing it. And I recommend people to do this. And it's just like, it'll just feel great for me and have that sense of like self-accomplishment being like, yeah, I can do stuff like this.
And Brian, as we wrap up, there might be somebody listening now who works at a school or a local housing nonprofit thinking, this would be a great idea to steal. What would you recommend for them to get started on something like this?
Absolutely. But it takes a partnership. We have an advisory team, so we've brought in the local industry people as well as, like I said, a nonprofit, because let's face it, with school district budgets the way they are, the school isn't in the business of funding and building a house. So you're going to need some partners in that effort. But you find some people that are in that area within your community and see if you can come together to fulfill needs, because it solves a problem for everybody. The city, who wants those vacant lots to be back on the tax rolls, the employers want employees, and the nonprofits are trying to fill low-cost housing alternatives. So it's a big win all the way around.
Well, I understand. I'm pulling you both off the job site right now, so I'll let you get back to work. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you.
Sounds good. Thank you very much.
That was Brian Furk, instructor for the Green Bay Area Public School District's construction program called Bridges, and Kira Brozek, a senior at Green Bay East High School, who's in that class right now. I talked to them earlier today. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Steve Gotcher.
Another summer is fading away, and try as we might to keep it here, fall and winter are just ahead. Amy Jo Barker reflects on summer delights and tells us how we might be able to preserve a little of it, even on the coldest nights.
The detritus of a beach day lies strewn about me, like so many artifacts, jutting half in and half out of the sand. I sit on my warm, rumpled towel, ice cream cone images stitched colorfully upon it, here in this sunny place between Bayfield and Washburn, Wisconsin. Later, I will sit and rest on driftwood, which lies on the beach, as I follow my children's small footprints and the memory of my father's large ones. Floaties, buckets, flip-flops, hats, oars, and umbrellas. Add to this sunburns, bug bites, splinters, and unidentifiable rashes. Each time we combine families, we add a few things, lose a few things, add a few memories, lose a few brain cells, have a few fights, dole out hugs and tears, maybe true confessions, maybe Whopper fishtails, maybe sincere apologies and musings. Time at the cabin, time at the beach, time with good friends, time with family, time to realize we are now. Life is now. A part of summer, a part of our interwoven lives, our childhood memories, our grown-up daydreams. Days in the still and cool waters, in the warm, swampy tadpole edges. Mornings on the porch, hands wrapped around warm coffee mugs with hushed conversations between. afternoons on the sand, in the bright sunshine, with screen door slams, cool glasses of lemonade and suds. Hours of packing, driving, and unpacking. Work first, and then the playing. Fishing, fishing, and fishing. Cleaning, cooking, family members, friends, sunsets. Lined up for dinner, oldest to newest. Plates rattling, glasses clinking. Everyone together in this place to savor summer. The Big Lake, Lake Superior, here beside the Shawangan Bay, means summer to me, but also the small inland lakes, with their cabins nestled and hidden in the woods, with long lines of family and friends trailing annually to meet one another. Summer in Wisconsin. Here in our woods, our lakes, our beaches, summer is summer more than any other place. It is in our hearts, our memories, our family histories, and our souls. Evenings on the dock, walking the woods, watching the pounding rains, kinging one another, stealing bishops and rooks, dealing cards, telling tales, slapping skeeters, laughter, smiles, sighs, stars, wishes. Days filled with pine cones and rock collections. Warm, sleeping children, happy hearts, beating the drum tap of days, dropping them one by one into life's jar like so many fireflies, so many glowing memories, added one upon another until full and overflowing with summers saved. Now crisp fall days and lean days of winter will come. Then the smell of pine and cedar will drift to our senses out of context, and we'll remember. We'll remember and run down cellar, peer at the jar, open the lid, and let it flow over us with a fond ache and a smile. Go ahead, dip in and eat it with a spoon of gratefulness. Summer canned, is there anything better? Summer.
Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Steve Gotcher.
Coming up, NASA is working on a series of missions to put humans back on the moon. A science journalist explains why they're doing it and what's delaying the first launch. That's next here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Humans haven't stepped onto the surface of the moon since the 1970s, but NASA is looking to bring us back with a series of missions called Artemis. The first Artemis mission will not have a human crew. Its launch has been delayed twice in the last couple weeks. NASA's plan is to include people on a launch in 2024 and touch down on the surface in 2025. What are the goals of the mission, and why has the first launch been delayed twice now? Eric Berger is senior space editor at Ars Technica and author of the book Liftoff, Elon Musk, The Desperate Early Days That Launched SpaceX. Eric, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you very much.
All right, there are a lot of things we could be trying to do in space. What led to bringing people back onto the surface of the moon becoming a priority again?
It really is a byproduct of the fact that NASA, for a while now, has wanted to get back into deep space exploration with astronauts. Not only have we not been back to the moon in 50 years, we haven't even sent people more than about 400 miles from the surface of the Earth. So the idea was NASA has been trying to figure out sort of the best course, and they've settled upon this plan to go back to the moon for the next 15 or 20 years, kind of figure things out, and then learn from that experience and eventually go on to Mars.
Artemis is a series of missions getting more complex over time, basically. Can you talk about their flight plan for Artemis?
Right. So the first mission, which may launch later this month, it may be later this year, we'll have to see, is basically a test flight of the rocket, the Space Launch System, and the spacecraft Orion, which they're going to fly out to the moon. It has to perform a series of engine firings to get into a proper orbit around the moon. And then it has to be successfully come back at a very high velocity and then, you know, come through Earth's atmosphere and splash down the Pacific Ocean. So if all of that goes well, then in a few years, I know you said 2024, I could very easily see it being later than that, they would fly a human mission out and around the moon and back, essentially a repeat of Apollo 8. And then the moon landing mission would follow on the third one later this decade.
You mentioned it might take longer than that timeline I said. You wrote recently about some internal documents from NASA that suggest that that timeline I laid out, the public timeline, might be really ambitious.
Yeah, you know, NASA spent more than a decade working on the Space Launch System rocket and Orion spacecraft, and it's been derided because it's to some extent been a jobs program for the space agency. But NASA was spending so much on those programs, it really wasn't able to have money left over for important things like landers or spacesuits that are able to function on the surface of the moon. So it's only been about the last year or so that they've started to fund those kinds of things. And if you're going to actually go down to the surface of the moon, you do need a lander and spacesuits and other things. And so because it's going to take a while to develop those, you know, we're probably looking at a lunar landing 26, 2027, 2028, sometime in that time frame.
The goal you mentioned to get astronauts out into space, what are the research interests here? What's the case that NASA is making that not just putting astronauts in space, but putting them on the moon is the best, you know, the best use of resources given competing priorities?
So there are very good reasons to go back to the moon. And you mentioned research. And one of the things about these Artemis missions is that they're not going to the equatorial regions of the moon like Apollo did. They're going to go to the poles, and in this case, the South Pole. And that's challenging because you get some daylight there and some not daylight. And then there's potentially ice at the poles. And in particular, in these permanently shadowed regions of craters near the South Pole, which never see the sun, it's believed that there's been accumulations of ice over the eons. And so scientists want to go check that out, and astronauts are a pretty good way of doing that. There are also important geopolitical reasons for NASA to be interested in going back to the moon. China is signaled its intent to send its astronauts there, certainly by 2030 or shortly thereafter. And NASA doesn't want to be in a position of following them, I think, back to the moon.
Talking to Eric Berger, senior space editor at Ars Technica, looking at the Artemis missions, the goal to eventually get people back on the moon. Well, Eric, here we are. As you mentioned, we don't know when this first step is going to go. Can you talk about the couple of delays and what has led to canceled launches?
Yeah, so NASA's been trying for the better part of 6 months now to fuel, to complete a fueling test of the Space Launch System rocket. This is a huge vehicle, many stories tall, weighs, you know, many, many, many tons. And it's, you know, when you fuel it, it takes more than 500,000 gallons of liquid hydrogen and more liquid oxygen on top of that. And it's a real challenge because liquid hydrogen is the smallest, you know, atom. And so it can get out of crevices and things like that when you're trying to connect these fuel lines to the rocket. And so it's just been a real challenge to dealing with this to fuel the vehicle. And so we've had a couple of countdowns where they've had to scrub it. One was for a hydrogen leak. Another was for other technical problems. And so NASA's, you know, this is the first time they tried to launch this large vehicle. And so they're struggling. And now they're looking, I think, at the first attempt in September 27th of this month, and potentially, if not then, early October.
There was talk, it seemed like, Eric, where, you know, NASA is going to be stepping out of the way in some ways and just kind of facilitating private space exploration in some way. This Artemis mission, how does that play out? Is this an all NASA gig? Is it a public-private joint operation? What's going on?
So this specific mission is definitely an all NASA or all government space mission. Part of the Orion capsule, the spacecraft, is powered by actually a module built by the European Space Agency, but it's all NASA and ESA. As you come further into the Artemis program, there are commercial elements. For example, the lunar lander we talked about is being provided by SpaceX. NASA went to them and got the best deal for Starship to go down to the surface of the moon. And the commercial spacesuits, or the spacesuits, were also basically NASA will be leasing those from private companies who will be developing their spacesuits for the surface of the moon. So it's starting out all government, but over time it's going to be transitioning to much more of a public-private partnership.
We've got this delayed first launch, assuming that it goes up later this month or whatever, or whenever, and it's successful. What is the next stage then, assuming we've got an Artemis success to kick things off with?
Right. So the Artemis 1 mission being a success would allow them to move on to Artemis 2. They've got to recover the Orion spacecraft, which is going to, as I say, splash down in the Pacific and really take a good look at its heat shield and make sure that it survived that fiery reentry through Earth's atmosphere. They've actually got to pull some of the computer boxes, about 16 of them, so-called avionics boxes, off of Orion, because they're going to reuse those for the second Artemis mission. And then they've got to announce the crew for that mission. It'll be four astronauts. We know one of them is likely to be a Canadian astronaut. And then get them ready, get the Orion spacecraft and the next rocket ready to launch. And they're saying earliest possible would be summer of 2024, but I would say right now it's more likely at least the first half of 2025 for Artemis II.
What are you watching for next to see how this Artemis program is going to go and the timeline it works on?
Well, they believe they've patched the hydrogen leak that occurred earlier this month at the Scrub second launch attempt. They're going to conduct a fueling test later this month, I think probably in 9 or 10 days from now, basically fuel most of the rocket to see if it leaks again. If that is successful, and if they get permission from the Space Force, which controls the launch range where they're trying to launch from, then they will probably try for a launch on September 27th. And then it's just really just watching, you know, can they execute? Can they get all the way through the countdown and lift this rocket off? I think that, you know, what we've seen on the first two tries suggests that the third well try may not be the charm.
Eric, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
My pleasure.
That's Eric Berger, senior space editor at Ars Technica, author of the book Liftoff, Elon Musk and the Desperate Early Days That Launched SpaceX. He was with us today to talk about why NASA is going back to the moon with its Artemis missions and why the project faced delays in its first launch. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, it can get harder to make friends as we get older, but it can be done. Get practical advice with the author of the book Platonic, How the Science of Attachment Can Help You Make and Keep Friends. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then massive heat waves in parts of the U.S. are putting strain on the energy grid. A Wisconsin power grid expert joins the show to tell us what's going on and how to fix things for the future. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. Central Time, I'm Rob Barrett. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, Governor Tony Evers laid out a proposal to spend $2 billion of a projected state budget surplus on schools. We get into some of his plans and how his goals compare with Republican candidate for governor Tim Michels. First, California just experienced a massive heat wave and it put their power grid to the test. As people turned up the AC, California called on residents to conserve energy, especially in the late afternoon and evening hours. While Wisconsin is definitely not in a heat wave today, there could be risks in the future, as climate scientists predict there's likely hotter summers and even warmer winters to come. Our next guest is an expert on power grids, the risks they can face, and what we can do to keep them from being overloaded in the future. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have family or friends in California dealing with that heat wave over the last week or so? Do you have thoughts on our power grid, the kinds of energy we rely on, the risks it faces in extreme weather? Thoughts or questions for our guest? 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. Lena Rold is an assistant professor of engineering at UW-Madison. She focuses on electric power systems, renewable energy, transmission and distribution grids, and energy system analysis. Lena, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you, Rob. It's a pleasure to be here.
I'm guessing you've been watching California very closely over the last week. Can you talk about this heat wave and what the stress it put on the power grid system there?
Yeah, right. Yeah, so it's been very hot in California, as I think most of us have heard. And in fact, it became so hot that people needed a lot of cooling from air conditioners. And it meant that the electricity grid in California actually produced or provided the highest amount of electricity to their customers ever in history. So they reached a new peak demand for electricity in California last week. And so the strain that happens then on the grid is that there is a lot of sun, which is good, because there's also a lot of solar PV generation in California. But what it becomes a challenge is when the sun is setting leaving us with less supply of electricity. But then in the afternoon, as the sun is starting to set, it's still really hot and people still want that air conditioning. And so that's why last week we saw calls to the public to conserve energy in the late afternoon between 4 and 7 p.m. in California.
That raises concerns about, you know, relying on solar power in situations like this. Are there ways to smooth that out when peak production is obviously when the sun is out, but the demand still continues, as you were saying, into the evening hours?
Yeah, so one thing that we saw in California in particular is that the utilities were asking people to consider whether they could be using electricity earlier in the day, where there was more generation available. So, for example, if you cool down your house during the middle of the day, it works a little bit like a battery. It gets cool and it stores that thermal coolness inside the house. And then when you get into the evening hours, your air conditioning does not have to work so hard. So then you can turn up the temperature a little bit again. And then for a while there in the evening, the air conditioning system does not have to work so hard. So in that sense, your house can work a little bit like a battery. Of course, another way of smoothing the electricity from solar PV is to use actual batteries. And so some people are, of course, also considering having home energy management systems that can also include batteries to provide power at other parts of the day. So store their own solar electricity for their own use later. But they can be quite expensive to install. And so one of the things that really all of us can do, also here in Wisconsin, if this would become a problem here, would be to really use the thermal capacity, as it's called, of our houses to sort of cool it down preemptively and then turn up the thermostat so that your air conditioning does not have to work so hard in the late afternoon.
So the problem you're talking about is, in effect, supply and demand. Do we have enough supply to meet the demand for electricity, in this case for air conditioning? That's just part of the power grid, though. Do you see concerns in California or maybe even here in Wisconsin for our systems of distributing electricity, getting it from the point of production to the people who are using it?
Yes. So that is also part of the problem. So one thing I would like to mention, though, is that solar PV, one of the good things about solar is that it does often provide electricity right when we need it, right? In the middle of the day, when it's really hot and sunny, you would like that air conditioning. And the solar PV actually generates power during that time. So that is really good news. One thing that is a challenge is that we need to transport the electricity, as you mentioned. And in fact, in California also last week, even on this day when it was really, really high demand for power, there was some of the solar PV generation that could not be used. So quite a lot of power, I mean, not the large amount relative to the total demand for electricity in California, but still, you know, a significant amount of power that could have powered several hundred homes could not be sent there because of a lack of transmission capacity. So we do need transmission lines to actually bring the power from where it is being produced to where it is getting consumed. And those transmission lines in some cases are the large transmission lines that are very high voltage, but it can also be that we need reinforcements to our smaller transmission lines, so the ones that are around our houses, as people are getting more solar PV on their roof and so on.
We're talking to Lena Rold from UW-Madison, assistant professor of engineering there, looking at our power grid systems in California after that big heat wave they just had really put it to the test, as you heard, record electrical generation there to meet that demand. What it could all mean for Wisconsin. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are there changes you would like to see in how we get and distribute our electricity? Do you have questions for our guest about how all of this works from generation to the point where we use it and all points in between? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. All right, Lena, people might be thinking, okay, that's California. They can get a big heat wave. Is this something we could worry about in a future Wisconsin summer?
Yes, indeed it is. Already this spring, the North American Electric Reliability Corporation, so-called NERC, they warned that in the Midwest region, we are actually at a heightened risk for experiencing this type of event, where we might be lacking enough generation capacity to support the demand. So if we had seen a very hot summer, potentially also coupled with other kinds of outages, which could, for example, happen due to bad weather, then we could have been in a situation where we would also have seen calls on people to conserve electricity, particularly during very high demand periods. And so as we are moving into the future with climate change, we know that there is going to be hotter summers. And in particular, not only are average temperatures going to increase, but we also know that the extent, so the areas that are affected by a heat wave all at once, and also the severity of heat waves might be increasing or are likely to increase. And so we might also see these type of events affecting our part of the grid in the future.
Now, a while back, Lena, I talked to you about a big energy problem in Texas. Cold weather created high demand, and part of the problem was the cold weather itself damaged some of the energy production and distribution infrastructure because it wasn't built for extreme cold like that. Can we see a similar thing with hot weather, where the heat itself can affect the infrastructure and make either production or distribution more difficult?
Yes, absolutely. So when it gets very hot, the electric lines that is carrying the power, they get warm, and so they expand, a thermal expansion of the lines, and then they can start to, that can start damaging the lines, meaning that you can send, you are not able to send as much electricity through them. So heat, very hot weather is already something that transmission operators are looking at, understanding how that is going to impact their transmission lines in the future. Also for generation, many generators, and in particular thermal generation, such as nuclear or coal power plants, or also nuclear natural gas power plant, they rely on water for cooling. And so if you have very hot weather and you get hot water in rivers, for example, you might actually reduce the effectiveness of those generators in producing power. And so there are definitely situations and many mechanisms by which heat impacts the electric grid and reduces its ability to both produce and transport electric power.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Ross is with us in Strum. Ross, hi.
Hello.
What did you want to bring up, Ross?
Well, I just wanted to say that I think we should put solar panels in the middle of the, in the medians on the interstate, because you already have high power lines there. And then people could set up charging stations along the interstate, and the power's already right where you need it.
Ross, interesting. Thanks for that call. I feel like I've seen pictures of something like that in South Korea, Lena, where they have corridors of solar power, but in the medians, and as Ross suggests, highways often are where the transmission lines run. What do you think?
Yeah, I think that's a great idea. I think we need to think about, land use for solar power is very important. Like, where do we actually have place to put them, and where can we connect them to those electric lines? So putting them along the interstate, that could be a great idea. And in particular, if we have those areas that are not, for example, used for agriculture, so that we don't displace other types of land use. Of course, one has to be careful about other, for example, wildlife and so on, who might also rely sometimes on having some access to nature. But yeah, I think that's a great idea.
Thanks for the call, Ross. We're talking to Lena Rold, Assistant Professor of Engineering at UW-Madison, focusing on electric power systems. She's talking to us about how heat waves impact the energy grid and the electricity in our own homes, and how to build good energy systems into the future. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have thoughts on what you'd want to see change or not change when it comes to the way we produce and distribute the electricity that we use? Do you have a question for our guest about this infrastructure and the risks it faces in extreme weather events? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our talk with Lena Rold, Assistant Professor of Engineering at UW-Madison, talking with us about the impact heat waves have on energy grids, how that can potentially cause electrical blackouts after a massive heat wave put power grids to the test in the western U.S. You may have seen the news from California over the last week. They are through the worst of the heat wave now, it sounds like. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have for our guest about how an extreme weather event like heat waves can affect our energy system? Do you want to see more renewable energy as part of our system? Do you worry about that, its reliability? Do you have questions? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We heard from Ron in Wisconsin Dells who couldn't stay with us. Ron asks, what are the plans to maintain grid stability with elimination of large high inertia steam plants? So Ron thinking, I think about things like, you know, the coal or natural gas or nuclear power plants that are big and really, I think, predictable. Lena, can we do it without big plants like that?
Yeah, so there are several challenges to that. So the first one is that those plants tend to be a little more controllable. We can often, for example, we can choose when we are going to generate electricity from coal, for example, because we know when we burn coal. And when we replace that with renewables such as wind and solar, we are kind of more subject to the weather, that when where the sun is shining and when the wind is blowing. There is another aspect of this, which is that these very large plants, and this might be what Ron also was referring to here, has something called inertia, because they are very, very big generators that are rotating at a very specific speed. And so if something happens in the grid, the very first thing that happens and the first response that we are getting from these big plants is that they might speed up a little bit or slow down just a little bit to keep our grid stable. And so this is actually one main challenge that we are seeing in the grid, is how do we replace that response which keeps our grid running at the 60 hertz frequency that we do want it to run at. So this is a little technical, but all electric power is running at 60 hertz, and so that has to do with the frequency of how quickly those big steam power plants are turning around. And so when we replace those big plants with solar, we do have to think about how we make sure that when something happens in the grid and we get a small or large disturbance, how do we replace that kind of speed up and slow down of those plants? And one of the good news is that solar and wind actually are able to provide some responses much, much quicker than those big power plants. So they might not have that inertia, but they are controlled by power electronics, which is a very fast kind of control device that really can make the grid even more responsive than it is today. So in that sense, as long as we get the controls right, we are actually in pretty good shape. The challenge now is that we have to get those controls right, and that is a very active and ongoing research area. But we are seeing success with very high penetrations of renewable generation in many parts of the grid. And I think that has been one of the really great things that happened over the past 10 years or so, is that, you know, we researchers, we like to say, oh, we can reach 30% of solar and everything is still safe. But what has happened now is that in many cases, we have seen countries and regions reach much, much higher penetration, closer to 100%. And they are still running safely. So, for example, California was in the news earlier this year in spring with news that they were powered 100% by renewable energy for a short period of time in April. And so I think that these stability issues, they are there, they are important, and we need to care about them. But we are really getting there on the technical side to figure out how to do this. And I think that is really a great engineering achievement over the past decade or so.
We're talking with UW engineering professor Lena Rold about our power grid in Wisconsin and around the United States. Let's go back to your calls at 800-642-1234. Douglas is calling from by Franklin. Douglas, hi.
Hello.
What did you want to bring up, Douglas?
How are you doing? So what I was curious about was what the guest's view was on inherently safe nuclear reactors, specifically the class of molten salt thorium.
Well, you're breaking up there, Douglas, but thorium reactors, I heard there are new generations, Lena, of nuclear power plants. Do you see them as promising potential contributors?
So I think that's a great question. So thanks for bringing that up, Douglas. I will say I am not at all an expert specifically on different types of nuclear reactors. So I do not think I can speak very detailed to that particular kind of reactors. What I do think is that nuclear power has an important role to play as a stable and reliable source of low carbon electricity. And so I hope that we are going to continue to be able to leverage nuclear power in order to be able to keep our electricity grid running and stable. When it comes to new designs, there's a lot of very exciting things that are happening. Also, we have developments in smaller and more modular nuclear reactors. But all of this has to be, of course, very, very carefully tested and very carefully thought through so that we know what to do, both to keep them operating safely, but also that we know what to do with nuclear waste. And we see that there are sometimes challenges with nuclear power plants. In countries which have a lot of nuclear power, there has been some recent issues coming up with actually newer types of reactors in France, for example. So there are also challenges with nuclear power, and as there is with any generating technology. So I think that I hope it can be part of the mix in the future, and hopefully we can get technologies that are even more safe and also have less waste problems.
Douglas, thanks for that call. Kathy joins us now in Prairie du Chien. Kathy, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to ask about, Kathy?
Okay. I was thinking that the normal electricity that's produced seems to function your refrigerator, your lights, your normal things in your homes. So the air conditioning is what seems to be pushing it over the edge. And so I was wondering if central air units that are in homes, on businesses and in you know, factories and things could have automatic solar power immediately to boost them specifically along to help with those times.
Oh, and are you, Kathy, thinking, you know, you buy your AC and you get a solar panel that's dedicated to it?
Exactly.
Gotcha. Kathy, interesting idea. What do you think, Lena? We actually custom make our solar to go with those AC units.
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting idea, Kathy. Maybe you could develop something like that. That could be a hit, I think. The challenge is, of course, if the sun is not shining, or if you live in a place where you don't own a roof to put the solar on. And so we do see that that air conditioning, for many people, they might lack the opportunity to actually put it on their home. For example, if they live in a high-rise building, there might just not be enough space for it, right? And they might still need air conditioning. We think of air conditioning as sort of maybe something that is convenient and nice to have. But if it gets a lot hotter, it is actually quite important that people have access to ways of staying cool, because in the future we might be seeing more types of weather where heat becomes dangerous. And so heat waves are actually the type of extreme weather that kills the most people. And in particular, older people who are medically fragile or also the people who have certain health conditions, they really need an opportunity to stay cool. So air conditioning is not only kind of something that is nice to have. It can be a lifeline for many people. And having it along with a solar panel, I mean, I think that would be a product I would think about. So.
Thanks for that call, Kathy.
Like that idea.
And Lena, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. And thanks for all the questions.
That's Lena Rold, Assistant Professor of Engineering at UW-Madison, talking to us about the power grid and how it's affected by heat waves. Coming up, we compare and contrast each of the Wisconsin governor candidates' proposals for education here in the state. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time.